Hello and welcome to the reading of the Courier, the e-edition, for Tuesday, November 21st. And I am your reader, Peter Welch, and this is IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Well, hi, everybody out there. I hope that you're all doing well. We've got 2 days before Thanksgiving, and whatever you're doing, I hope that you have lots of good health and enjoy being with your friends and relatives during this holiday season. All right, let's take a look at the Courier, the e-edition here. Let's see what we have here. Outbreak of bird flu less severe this year. Shoppers will see smaller impact on poultry eggs costs. In Omaha, Nebraska, nearly 5 million chickens and turkeys and other birds have been slaughtered this year because of a persistent bird flu outbreak that began in 2022. But as big as the number may sound, it's far less than the number of birds killed last year, which means that consumers aren't seeing as much impact on poultry and egg prices. The 4.6 million birds killed this year compares to the nearly 58 million birds the Department of Agriculture said were slaughtered last year in the first year of the outbreak. While that decline is welcome news, the fact that infections continue is a worrisome indication that, unlike earlier outbreaks, the current virus has found a way to survive through the summers, and poultry will always likely be at risk of the disease. The key problem with the bird flu is that the highly contagious virus is spread easily by wild birds through droppings and nasal discharges, and it mutates over time. Despite the best efforts of farmers, it's hard to keep the virus out. The industry is definitely on really high alert, says veterinarian Denise Hurd with the U.S. Poultry and Egg Association Trade Group. As geese and ducks have started to head south for the winter, cases of bird flu have predictably begun popping up primarily at farms in Minnesota, Iowa, and South Dakota, along one of the major flyways for migrating birds. The USDA reported Saturday that the bird flu had been detected in a mixed species backyard flock in Cerro Gordo County. Most of those cases involved only tens of thousands of birds, but 1.2 million birds at one Iowa egg farm and and another 940,000 chickens at one Minnesota egg farm had to be slaughtered last week after the disease was found. Still, only a small portion of the total flock nationwide has been affected this year, allowing prices to fall closer to where they were before the outbreak began. State program for direct support staff meant to bolster workforce. In Waterloo, like mother, like daughter, Amanda Scarborough felt stuck in her job, and the money was good, but it wasn't fulfilling. I wanted something more. Then she came across the North Star Community Services website and began reading about a new apprenticeship program. The more I read, the more excited I was, said the 42-year-old, former paralegal. And the single mom also mentioned that the apprenticeship opportunity to her daughter, Elia, age 20, I thought it would be perfect for her because she has a passion for helping people. She didn't know what to do with her future, and I thought it sounded like something she'd like to do very well, said Amanda. The mother and daughter duo started their registered direct support professional apprenticeships at North Star less than a month ago. We have people in our family who have disabilities. I've always been someone who puts others' needs ahead of my own, said Alea. I'm glad I'm getting to work with my mom. We really are best friends. North Star is one of the first in the state to offer the apprenticeship program, and the only program in Northeast Iowa. The Scarboroughs are the first to enter the apprenticeship. North Star's guiding philosophy is helping adults with a range of disabilities live the life they want to live. DSPS helps make their independence possible and are at the heart of the program, said Jody Muller, North Star donor and public relations director. DSPS are the reason we can succeed in providing support to people living with one or more identified disabilities. The very reason that 160,000 Iowans with disabilities are able to live largely independent lives of their choosing and to live self-directed community and social lives, she explains. This new apprenticeship program is designed to help address workforce shortages, said Valerie Kerr, North Star Executive Director. There really are two aspects of the program. One is to start working trends addressing the workforce crisis in this industry. The other piece of apprenticeship is to change the image or perception of direct support professional positions. And she goes on to describe it as a hidden profession viewed as an entry-level position and not one that is recognized as a career path or profession. The apprenticeship will turn that perception around and bring increased opportunities and increased wages and more appreciation for what DSPS do, Schwarzwerger goes on to explain. In addition to North Star, Mueller also said that the program will benefit our peer providers as well. In March, a quick search of Indeed showed listings for over 572 DSP openings in the state, and I'm sure that that number isn't much improved. Okay, let's take a look here at some other front page news here. Man sentenced for break-ins in Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been sentenced for breaking into downtown businesses this spring. Darian Bryceland Jones, age 25, pleaded to two counts of third-degree burglary and one count of possession of burglary tools on the 9th of November in Black Hawk County District Court. He was sentenced to up to 5 years in prison, suspended to 2 years to 5 years of probation, with up to 1 year at the Waterloo Residential Facility. Authorities allege that Jones broke into the Savvy Bean Coffee Shop on East 4th Street in the early morning hours of May 13th. He then went to the Dark Rose Saloon, the Dark Rose Salon on Commercial Street. Officers arrived when he was still inside the Dark Rose. He was detained when he exited the building, according to court records. He was carrying a flashlight and a screwdriver. Jones also pleaded to one count of misdemeanor, fourth-degree theft, in November 2022 incident where he allegedly pawned a PlayStation 5 that had been stolen in a home burglary. Women convicted of lottery fraud in Waterloo. Sentencing has been set for December for an Evansdale woman who was convicted of cashing in her roommate's winning lottery ticket. Prosecutors said that Sandra Jean Crow, age 64, turned in the $30,000 candy cane crossword scratch ticket so Alvin Hans Larson III wouldn't have to apply it toward his outstanding debt to the city. A Blackhawk County jury found Crow guilty of misdemeanor lottery fraud on the 14th of November following trial. A judge dismissed a felony lottery fraud charge in the case. Authorities said that Larson, who's age 45, bought the $3 ticket at a Waterloo convenience store in 2022, but after discovering it was a winner, he was concerned officials would hold the money and use it to pay off earlier debts, including about $500 he owed to the city of Evansdale. Crow cashed in the game ticket at the Iowa Lottery office in Cedar Rapids and received a $21,300 lump sum. About a month later, police were called to a disturbance at their home, and officers overheard them arguing about the winnings, including allegations that Larson was the original purchaser, according to authorities. Larson was also arrested in the lottery investigation, and he pleaded to misdemeanor lottery fraud in October of 2023. He was granted a deferred judgment, which will remove the charge from his record if he completes 2 years of probation. All right, let's see. What else do we have going on here in the paper today? We've got Waterloo mom arrested for hitting teen daughter. A Waterloo woman has been arrested for allegedly punching her teen daughter in the mouth in 2022. Black Hawk County Sheriff's deputies arrested Amber Lynn Smith, age 34, on Wednesday on a warrant for one count of child endangerment, causing bodily injury, and four counts of child endangerment. Bond was set at $7,000. The arrest stems from August 2022 incident where Waterloo police were called to Smith's home on Avon Street shortly after midnight. Officers found a 14-year-old girl bleeding from the mouth. There were four other children, ages 6, 8, 11, and 12, in the home, and Smith appeared to be intoxicated, according to the court records. The children were placed with another relative, and the arrest warrant was issued in December of 2022, court records state. All right, let's see. You know what I'm going to read here, just briefly, a couple things. Birthdays. And these birthdays, of course, are well-known people, celebrities. Actor Lawrence Luckinbill is 89. Mario Thomas is 86. Actor Juliet Mills, Passions and Nanny and The Professor, is 82. Actor Goldie Hawn is 78. Lonnie Jordan of War is 75. Steve Curtis Chapman is 61. Actor Nicolette Sheridan is 60. Singer Bjork is 58. Singer Chauncey Hannibal of Blackstreet is 55. All right. Well, that's good. And there are a whole bunch more there. All right. Let's go to the next page here. This is, even though we're on the third page, this continues to be front page news because obviously they can't get it all on one page. This next one also is in Waterloo. Man gets prison in meth trafficking case. A Waterloo man has been sentenced to federal prison in connection with a ring that moved pounds of methamphetamine from California to Iowa. Timothy Michael Weber, age 46, was sentenced to 15 years and 8 months on a charge of possession of meth with intent to distribute during a November 2nd hearing in the U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids. The sentence was the lowest under the recommended sentencing guidelines. Following prison, Weber will be on supervised release for 5 years. Authorities said that Weber was involved in a meth operation run by David Poitier, Blood Belton, and Derek Michael D. Moe Mims between 2017 and 2022. Belton and Mims and other obtained ice meth from Jesus Papa Varela. I guess I should say it's probably Jesus Papa Varela in the Los Angeles area, and recruited drivers to move 30 to 60 pounds at a time. According to court records, drivers usually made $2,000 a trip plus expenses. Once the meth arrived in Cedar Rapids, Mims and Belton broke it down into smaller quantities and passed it on to retailer dealers like Weber in Waterloo and Cedar Rapids. Prosecutors estimated that the ring moved about 399 pounds of meth in total. One shipment hidden in a Volkswagen Passat on a commercial car carrier was intercepted by investigators in New Mexico in October of 2020. Another shipment was found following a chase and crash near Fort Dodge, Iowa in January of 2021. A shipment of 60 pounds in a rental truck was seized by Nebraska law enforcement in February of 2022. And a courier with 2 kilograms of meth in vacuum-sealed bags hidden in a roller suitcase was detained in Los Angeles International Airport that same month. Here, candidate who died on Raymond ballot. Runoff rules are have prevented his name from being taken off the council race. In Waterloo, Raymond is holding a runoff election December 5th after one of the candidates on the ballot for 3 at-large city council seats didn't receive a large enough share of the votes. But there was another problem. When all the votes were tallied following the November 7th election, candidate Tom McGowan had died. His death on October 13th came after the deadline passed at the end of September to withdraw names from the ballot. McGowan received 17 votes in the regular election, but based on formula that accounts for the number of votes of voters casting ballots, he needed to receive at least 21 votes to win the seat. The two candidates running, Rebecca Pint and Larry Thies, received 47 and 43 votes, respectively. Raymond, along with Waterloo and Cedar Falls, are the only cities in the Blackhawk County to hold runoff elections. And Waterloo will also have, bear with me, I got to turn the page, will also have a runoff election on the 5th of December between at-large city council candidates Jonathan Greeter and Steve Simon. Besides the three cities, every other Blackhawk County municipality is a Chapter 45 city, meaning that the person with the most votes will win. Most small cities in the state are Chapter 45 cities. Raymond decided to become a city with runoff elections in 2019 to prevent having the County Board of Supervisors draw a name out of a hat if there is a tie. Janesville Library, a living room for a small community. A new facility held grand opening on the 4th of November. In Janesville, there's always something going on at the newly opened Janesville Public Library. From the get-go, Library Director Lisa Biesner said that the aim for the facility at 319 Main Street was to be more than a place to check out books. Staff strives to create an activity or community living room for the small town. That's a phrase that we thought of early on with our grant writing and staff, and that's something we really tried to stay true to. Biesner goes on to say, as popcorn was being made for the Wednesday afternoon movie. And the library has been meeting this goal with numerous events for children and adults, ranging from films and documentary screenings to board game nights to arts and craft sessions. According to Biesner, they're acting on the desires and the feedback on the juvenile, the Janesville community. This is a public place. This is what the community wants it to be, Biesner goes on to explain. And we have really worked hard to listen to our community and what materials they wanted us to have, what programs they're interested in, and what kind of space they want. All right, we are now in the opinion section of today's e-edition of the Courier, and it's also called Another View. So let's take a look here and see what is what here. All right, let's take a look at this first one here. Republicans still have time to dump Trump, pick Haley. And by the way, this is written by Lynn Schmidt, who hosts the What Keeps You Up at Night podcast. Let's take a look. Let's see what she has to say. It's time for Republicans who care about foreign policy, are hawkish on national security, or who want to win back the White House to get behind Nikki Haley. The former South Carolina governor and U.N. ambassador has what it takes to keep America safe. What she does not have is enough support from the Republican primary voters. Haley's campaign comes at a time when GOP voters are increasingly isolationists, prefer personality over policy, and seem soft on Russian President Vladimir Putin. Can Haley land her message of carrying a big stick following in the footsteps of the 26th President of the United States and fellow Republican Teddy Roosevelt, who used the phrase to describe his foreign policy to the American people? Will she be able to move enough voters between now and the primaries? My niece was given an assignment by a college professor, list the top non-personal events that have taken place in your lifetime. The rest of the family made their lists as a fun activity. Six out of this Generation X's top 10 were the results of foreign affairs. While most Americans do not vote on foreign policy, the exercise suggested to me that maybe we should. With the GOP presidential primary field winnowing, Haley remains the clearest opponent to the former president, especially when it comes to Meadows of foreign policy, national security, and military defense. She's knowledgeable and articulate in the threads facing the United States and democracies around the world. Back in September, Haley told a reporter from Reuters that she wants Americans to know why a win for Russia is a win for China. She went on to connect the dots between Ukraine and China and Russia and Taiwan, explaining if Ukraine wins, China walks away and does not invade Taiwan. Haley has consistently denounced Russia in her first speech before the UN Security Council in 2017. Haley criticized Russia for invading Ukraine and the annexation of the Crimean Peninsula in 2014. Haley was one of the Trump administration's fiercest critics of Russia, declaring that we should never trust Russia, and Russia is never going to be our friend. Haley has argued for strengthening the U.S. relationship with Taiwan and other Asian allies as one way to get tough on China. She would plan to build up the U.S. military as a deterrent and has said we need to let China know there will be hell to pay if they touch Taiwan. Haley has been a strong defender of Israel. She is supportive of our NATO allies and has even recommended Ukraine join NATO. Of course, Trump is ahead of Haley by more than 40 percentage points in the polls. For the sake of contrast, here is a rundown of a few of Trump's foreign policy objectives and some recent statements. Trump called Chinese President Xi Jinping a brilliant man who rules with an iron fist. Trump continuously praises Putin and calls Putin's invasion of Ukraine smart. Trump referred to Hezbollah, the Iran-backed militant group, as very smart. Trump told a crowd in Iowa that he would not back a NATO country if Russia attacked them, and has repeatedly stated that his desire to withdraw the U.S. from NATO if he were to be reelected. Former Trump administration National Security Advisor John Bolton describes Trump's foreign policy as erratic and ineffective, saying that he, meaning Trump, doesn't think in policy directions when he makes decisions, certainly in the national security space. It's all connected with how things benefit Donald Trump. If Haley's strong foreign policy cred is not enough to persuade voters, then maybe her electability will do the trick. The most recent New York Times Siena poll of the battleground states of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin shows Haley beating Biden in all six battleground states. Haley leads by a wider margin than Trump against Biden in four of the six. An Emerson College poll shows Haley beating Biden in New Hampshire 45% to 39%. Haley needs to take that big stick while wearing her self-reported five-inch heels on the road and keep explaining to Republican voters in another, in a particular way, isolationism, is bad, why policy over personality will keep America safer, and that she is a winner in the general election. Haley's path to beating Trump will be challenging. It will likely take independents, and Democrats voting in open Republican primaries to even get her close to the former president. If you believe in peace through strength, then pick Nikki Haley. Break spell and defend Walt Disney. Florida legislature should stop DeSantis from wreaking havoc in the Magic Kingdom. Once upon a time, a powerful wizard came to Central Florida from a far distant land with a promise. He would transform a vast spread of drowsy acres dotted with orange groves and forests into a beacon of happiness and prosperity that would shine throughout the world. In return, he demanded a high price, a gift of power over that land, something he said was needed to support the magic he planned to will into being. Even then, with the wizard himself standing before them, some doubted the wisdom of the bargain. But others were dazzled and said yes. Walt Disney's death in December of 1966 didn't weaken the spell he cast. The next summer, the Florida legislature approved of the creation of the Reedy Creek Improvement District. And for more than 50 years, that district did exactly what Walt Disney envisioned and promised, creating the framework for a magical kingdom and so much more. Reedy Creek supplied the water, electricity, streets, and meticulous planning that turned the acres the Walt Disney Corporation controlled into the most powerful economic force in central Iowa. Protected from the whim of local politics, the district nurtured Disney's resort's explosive growth. Nobody foresaw a day when the vengeful political whims of one man would turn the peaceful kingdom of Reedy Creek into Disney's greatest vulnerability. And if Governor Ron DeSantis is forced to return to Florida, embittered after watching his presidential aspirations burn, there's no telling the mischief that he could wreak havoc. Someone must stop him, and those champions must rise from the group he has already conquered. The Florida legislature, which should act in the coming session to curb the governor's grasp over the former district. DeSantis has already done considerable damage, treating the district's leadership as treasure chests that he has invited unqualified political allies to plunder. His shenanigans have already led to the company pulling the plug on a development that would have brought thousands of jobs to Lake Nona. If he chooses, he can command those cronies to wreak real havoc, acting in ways that disrupt Disney's transportation network, shut off the power with the parks at their fullest, or throttle water supplies, just as tourists are returning to hundreds of hotel rooms after long days of playing under the Florida sun. Would he do it? Well, nobody knows. If lawmakers don't modify the laws that grant the governor so much power, DeSantis almost certainly knows how much damage he can do. Earlier this year, he spoke of ways he could hamper Disney's kingdoms by leasing land to rival parks, seizing it for a state prison, or taking other action aimed directly at the economic viability of the Disney properties. It's time for lawmakers to break the spell DeSantis has cast and rewrite the law to curb his power and restore some semblance of ethics, accountability, and trust to the district's operations. If they don't, Central Florida's economy could be so devastated that not even wishing on a star will save it. Another View column I just read came from the Orlando Sentinel. All right, now let's take a look here. Some obituary news. And I also want to remind you that you are listening to the reading of the e-edition of the Courier for Tuesday, November 21st. And I am your narrator, Peter Welch, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Okay, let's take a look here. Rivers Calhoun has passed at the age of 70 at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. And let's see, I'm looking here to see if there are any funeral arrangements. Bear with me for just a second here while I take a look here. Okay, and I don't see anything else there regarding any funeral services. Paul Graham has passed at the age of 91 of rural Waterloo, Iowa, passed on Wednesday at Bickford Cottage Assisted Living in Cedar Falls. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, the 22nd, at the White Funeral Home in Jessup, Iowa, with burial at Old Barclay Cemetery in Jessup. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, 21st of November, at the funeral home, and memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be also posted at www.white-mounthope.com. Okay. Irene Stickley has passed from Parkersburg at the age of 96. And let's see, let's take a look here and see what we've got for funeral services. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, the 22nd of November, at the Calvary Baptist Church, with burial in the Oak Hill Cemetery. Both in Parkersburg, visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the Rebin Funeral and Cremation Services, Parkersburg Funeral Home, and 1 hour before services at the church. Sharon Kreb has passed at the age of 86 of Cedar Falls. And let's see here for any services. Bear with me here for just a moment. Here we go. Sharon's memorial service will be held at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, the 25th of November, at Windhaven Assisted Living Facility with private family burial at Fairview Cemetery, both of Cedar Falls. Okay, and in lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Western Home Communities, Fresh Wind Ministries, or their Employee Appreciation Fund, care of Jorgensen Plaza, 5307 Caraway Lane in Cedar Falls in Iowa, 50613. That is the zip code. All right, let's see if we've got any other news there regarding that. I think we're done. So let us now return to that last editorial that I mentioned to you just a couple of minutes ago. Social media is addictive, but that is not a crime. This is written by Stephen L. Carter. Big Tech loses bids to toss lawsuits alleging that social media platforms harm children, the New York Post blared this previous week. Social media companies must face youth addiction lawsuits, U.S. judge rules, Reuters wrote. Such news coverage of the order from Judge Yvonne Gonzalez Rogers suggests that the tech companies mostly lost. But from my perspective as a Yale University law professor, Silicon Valley mostly won. Yes, Judge Rogers let stand a significant fraction of the claims in the hundreds of lawsuits that had been consolidated in her courtroom. But the most spectacular allegations that social media addicts, teens, and with damages of their health were mostly dismissed. The lawsuits at issue were filed by parents, organizations, and state attorneys general against the companies facing or behind Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, and Snapchat. The defendants moved to dismiss under the First Amendment in Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996. Judge Rogers dismissed a large chunk of the lawsuit, but allowed a number of the claims to go forward. Along the way, addiction practically vanished from the case. Just go through the allegations, the biggies. Use of algorithms to promote addictive engagement. Said timing and clustering of notifications of third-party content in a way that promotes addiction are barred by Section 230, writes Judge Rogers. Why? Because they're the sort of things publishers do. They want your attention. They work to keep it. That's quintessential publishing behavior. The judge's opinion picks up on precisely the weakest part of the argument, that social media addicts us. The difficulty isn't whether the premise is true. It's whether the premise is punishable. Nobody thinks a traditional publisher is at fault for doing all it can to keep fans sufficiently hooked that they'll buy millions of copies of the next volume of a song in Ice and Fire when it comes out, or that the producers of Succession acted wrongfully when they structured the tale so that viewers could scarcely wait to find out what would happen next. What Judge Rogers left in place were a number of theories about product liability, that the companies know their services carried some risk, but failed to either mitigate it or warn users. There's some meat there, to be sure. The plaintiffs will be allowed to argue, for instance, that the defendants make it too hard to close accounts and that they should offer more robust parental controls. If you're struggling to raise children in the face of the online onslaught, these are far from trivial issues. And the tech companies should be ashamed of themselves. But the product liability counts bear only a tenuous connection to the central claim of the lawsuits, that social media addicts, or I should say addicts, the young. I'm not arguing against the substantial body of evidence suggesting that social media can be addictive, especially in youngsters. A 2022 paper in the American Economic Review estimated that 31% of the social media use stems from lack of self-control. Lots of people want to cut back but struggle. The problem is genuine, but not every problem can be fixed by filing a lawsuit. Judge Rogers is correct in her view that Section 230 protects social media platforms when they act like publishers. And despite the steady drumbeat that the provision needs repeal or extensive revision, I'm among those who tremble at the thought of what government officials would do once granted broad authority over online content. What, then, is to be done? Well, call me an optimistic pessimist, because Judge Rogers preserved the product liability counts. The tech companies will likely seek a settlement under which they'll implement better parental controls and ease the tasks of users who wish to delete their accounts. Such changes regulate not a scintilla of content, yet should be helpful to concerned parents. The challenge of addiction, alas, is far too large to be fixed by a court. And again, Stephen Carter is a Bloomberg columnist and professor of law at Yale University. All right, let us move on here and see what else we've got here. Waverly Library gets a makeover. $2.9 million expansion revamp is underway. Big changes are coming to the Waverly Public Library. Construction's underway on the $2.9 million expansion and renovation project. Completion is expected this summer. In the meantime, at 1500 West Bremer Avenue, patrons will have to work around a change in services that started with a temporary closure through December 3rd. We're finally at a point where action is happening, said Library Director Sarah Meyer. And right now, most of the construction is happening on the new teen space. We're trying to get as much done as possible with the nice weather that we have had. The new 1,000-square-foot expansion part of the $1.85 million project being completed by Huff Contracting of Waterloo will be known as the Teens Technology and Youth Lounge. It's replacing a seldom-used patio, an example of how the library taking on its first big construction project since the building opened in 1998 is keeping its some 130,000 annual visitors top of mind with the massive project. It's been 25 years since we moved into this building, and we've had observed how people use the building and realized the great following of teens and kids, she said. There are all changes that are based on how the building is now being used. Plus, it hadn't been refurbished in 25 years, and it just had to be done. Meyer said that the new teen space will be named after the late Virginia Legischult, who was part of the well-known Legischult family, which was among the generous donors. Additionally, the project includes new quiet, dense space and a children's area expansion, as well as more computer space, studying rooms, and seating. Now we're in the Cedar Valley section of today's paper. Veterans Memorial Hall Fund to support historic building in Waterloo. Waterloo's Memorial Hall Commission is providing a new opportunity to honor and remember the community's veterans through the Veterans Memorial Hall Fund. The fund was established to support the ongoing operations, maintenance programs, and special projects at Veterans Memorial Hall and Soldiers and Sailors Park. The commission is comprised entirely of volunteers and is dedicated to preserving the building and the artifacts it holds. Veterans Memorial Hall was built in 1915 by Civil War and Spanish-American War veterans. The building is on the National Register of Historic Places and the site of Memorial Day and Veterans Day ceremonies and community events. Waterloo Holiday Kickoff is set on Saturday. Waterloo Lights the Night, a downtown kickoff to the holiday season, will be held on Saturday. Experience Waterloo announced that the third annual event will be from 6 to 8 p.m. at Anton's Garden, located at the corner of East 4th and Sycamore Streets. The free event is a Christmas block party with Santa Claus, a tree lighting, fireworks, and an elf DJ, llamas, and more. children will be able to visit with Santa. There'll also be a llama Christmas village, children's games, hot chocolate and cookies, Christmas cocktails, and a toy drive for families in need. All right, let's take a look here. Let's see what we have here. We've got a, let me read this, a quick metro brief for Waterloo, Cedar Valley Thrift and Outreach Outlet, along with Flip's Grill, will host a meal in the days before Thanksgiving. The free meal will start at 4 p.m. Wednesday and continue until the food is gone at Flip's Grill at 921 Broadway Street. The meal is a dine-in or carry-out. The menu consists of turkey, ham, pulled pork, macaroni, cheese, macaroni and cheese, greens, sweet potatoes, gravy, dressing, corn, dinner rolls, cranberry sauce, and a drink. Those who are disabled, sick, or can't leave their house can call between noon and 2 p.m. on Wednesday to have their food delivered. Any questions can be directed to Carmen at the following number, 319-433-8893, or Flip at 319-961-7693. And there will also be a donation box at the meal. Continue on. Oh, yes. Can't miss this, folks. The weather. Let's take a look at this. See what's going on here in our area. Today, it will be breezy with periods of sun, and the wind will be between 10 and 20 miles per hour, and the high will be 47. Tonight will be mainly clear and not very windy, low of 24. Wednesday, times of sun and clouds. The winds will be very, very low, a high of 50 degrees and a low of 30. And then on Turkey Day, partly sunny and cooler and very low wind, a high of 42 and a low of 21. And on Friday, mostly cloudy, very low wind, a high of 36, a low of 20. And then outlook for Saturday, it will be cloudy. Again, very low wind, a high of 40 degrees and a low of 22. And then the national weather forecast outlook here, it says severe thunderstorms are expected from the Florida Panhandle to parts of the Carolinas today. Heavy rain will spread over much of the Northeast and continue in the Midwest. A wintry mix will fall over the upper Midwest and the interior mid-Atlantic, but mostly snow is in store for northern New England. Rain will begin in western Washington. And they also mentioned today that, you know, everyone who's traveling up there in the northeast area are going to be coming into some rather sloppy weather. So I know we all love to have snow, but not if you're driving in it. Okay, let's see what else we've got here. Let's go to 360. Okay, we're looking now at the 360 degrees national and world report. Let's see what we've got here. Israel-Hamas war. Entire families have been lost. Palestinians grappling with tragedy in Gaza. In the Gaza Strip, the night a blast struck his family's home, in the Gaza Strip, Ahmad al-Nauk was more than 2,000 miles away, but he still jolted away, consumed with the inexplicable panic. He reached for his cell phone to find that a friend had written and then deleted a message. Al-Nauk called him from London. The words that spilled from the other end of the line landed like world-shattering blows, airstrike. Everyone killed. Four nights later, Amar al-Bata was startled from sleep in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis when the wall of his bedroom collapsed over him. A missile had pierced his top floor apartment and exploded one floor below. He lurched over the rubble, shining the light of his cell phone into the wreckage, calling out to his 16 relatives. "Anyone there?" he cried. There was only silence. Entire generations of Palestinian families in the besieged Gaza Strip, from the great-grandparents to infants only weeks old, have been killed in airstrikes in the Israeli-Hamas war, in which the Israeli army says it aims to root out the militant group from the densely populated coastal territory. Attacks are occurring at a scale never seen in years of the Israel-Hamas conflict, hitting residential areas, schools, hospitals, mosques, churches, even striking areas in southern Gaza, where Israeli forces ordered civilians to flee. Israel says that the goal of the war is to destroy Hamas following the militant group's deadly October 7th rampage in southern Israel that killed at least 1,200 people, and it maintains that the attacks target militant operatives and infrastructure. Some 240 hostages were also taken in the October 7th attack. Israel blames the high Palestinian death toll, more than 11,000 people, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, on Hamas, saying that the group endangers civilians by operating among the population and in tunnels underneath the civilian areas. Israel says that the death toll includes Hamas fighters, but the scope of the destruction, the loss of life in Gaza, with entire families wiped out in a single strike, has raised troubling questions about Israeli military tactics. It would take many hours of horror and mayhem before the truth would settle, like the ash from October 22nd's explosion that leveled Al-Nuwak's family home. 21 relatives are dead. They included his 75-year-old father, two brothers, three sisters, and their 13 children. In Seattle, election officials are preparing for fentanyl-laced letters, the suspicious letters sent to vote centers and government buildings in six states this month, were undeniably scary, some containing traces of fentanyl or white powder, accompanied by not-so-veiled threats and dubious political symbols. Harkening back to the anthrax attacks that killed five people in 2001, the mailings are prompting election officials already frustrated with the ongoing harassment and threats to reach out to local police, fire, and health departments for help stocking up on the overdose reversal medication naloxone. Even if there's a little risk from incidental contact with the synthetic opioid, having the antidote on hand isn't a bad idea amid an addiction epidemic that is killing more than 100,000 people in the U.S. every year. And it can provide some assurance for stressed ballot workers, election managers go on to say. My team is usually in the direct fire just because we're opening up thousands of millions of ballots depending on the election, said Eldon Miller, who leads the ballot opening staff at King County Elections in Seattle, which stocked up on naloxone after receiving a fentanyl-laced letter in August. I always say to my team, your safety is my utmost importance. The letters were sent this month to vote centers or government buildings in six states: Georgia, Nevada, California, Oregon, Washington, and Kansas. Some were intercepted before they arrived, but others were delivered, prompting evacuations and briefly delaying vote counts in local elections. The FBI and the U.S. Postal Inspection Service are investigating. Some of the letters featured an anti-fascist symbol, a Progress Pride flag, and a pentagram. While the symbols have sometimes been associated with leftist politics, they also have been used by conservative figures to label and stereotype the left. The center's political leanings were unclear. New report, climate woes on bad track. The globe is speeding to 2.5 to 2.9 degrees of global warming since pre-industrial times, set to blow well past the agreed-upon international climate threshold, a United Nations report calculated to have an even money shot at keeping warming to the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit adopted by the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Countries have to slash their emissions by 42% by the end of the decade, said the UN Environmental Programme's Emissions Gap Report issued on Monday. Carbon emissions from the burning of coal, oil, and gas rose 1.2% last year, the report says. This year, Earth got a taste of what's to come, said that the report, which sets the table for international climate talks later this month. Through the end of September, the daily global average temperature exceeded 1.5 degrees Celsius above mid-19th century levels on 86 days this year, the report said. But that increased to 127 days because nearly all of the first 2 weeks of November and all of the October reached or exceeded 1.5 degrees, according to the European Climate Service Copernicus. That's 40% of the days so far this year. On Friday, the globe hit 2 degrees Celsius, that's 3.6 degrees, above pre-industrial levels for the first time in recorded history, according to Copernicus Deputy Director Samantha Burgess. It's really an indication that we are already seeing a change, an acceleration, said report lead author Anne Holoff of Denmark's climate think tank Concito. Based on what science tells us, this is just like a whisper. What will be in the future will be more like a roar. The 1.5 degree goal is based on a time period measured over many years, not days, scientists said. And earlier reports put Earth's reaching that longer term limit in early 2029 without dramatic emission changes. To keep that from happening, the countries of the world have to come up with more stringent goals to cut emissions of carbon dioxide and implement policies to get on those goals, Olaf goes on to say. In the past 2 years, only 9 countries have come up with new goals, so that hasn't moved the needle. But some countries, including the U.S. and those in Europe, have put policies in place that slightly improved the outlook, she says. The U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, which has $375 billion in spending on clean energy by 2030, would reduce yearly emissions of carbon dioxide by about 1 billion metric tons. That sounds like a lot, but the world in 2022 spewed 57.4 billion. That's with a B, folks. Metric tons of greenhouse gases, and to limit warnings to the 1.5 degree mark, emissions in 2030 have to be down to 33 billion metric tons. That's an emissions gap of 24 billion metric tons. All right, let's turn to our last article here for the day here on the e-edition reading here of the Courier. Public transportation, e-ferry could alter the water travel. How about that? Sweden unveils high-tech vessel in Stockholm. Many cities around the world see clean and efficient public transport as a crucial way to lower their carbon emissions. For cities with waterways, a high-tech ferry in Sweden could soon set a new standard. Speeding through Stockholm's archipelago, electric boat maker Candela's new P12 vessel barely makes a sound as it glides over 3 feet above the ferry, which was unveiled last week, will yield a new era of waterborne public transport. This is a real leap forward, said Eric Eklund, who's in charge of the commercial vessel division at Candela. The energy savings we get by going airborne on the foils gives us the speed and the range we need to make this work on batteries. The vessel is designed to carry 30 passengers at a maximum speed of 335 miles per hour, which is considerably faster than other electric passenger ferries. It achieves this with carbon fiber hydrofoil wings that lift the boat out of the water, reducing drag. Well, that does it here for the reading of the Courier here, the e-edition, for Tuesday, November 21st, with Thanksgiving rapidly coming fast here. I do hope that you all have a wonderful, healthy, happy Thanksgiving. I also want to remind you that you've been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Reading Information Services Network for the Blind and the Disabled. Thank you so much. Take care, and we'll talk again soon. So long, everybody.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.